Keeping up with the mutations, scientists are racing to fight new coronavirus variants. We don't know the COVID situation in North Korea. They did seal off their borders, and that has changed the North Korean diet.
Rice is middle-class food. I mean, if you're middle-class, you can afford it in rice.
But these days, even rice is hard to come by. Also, across Europe, downhill skiing is shut down. So are the ski resorts.
It's devastating. We relied on tourism for the last 40, 50 years, so we can't change that in a heartbeat.
I'm Marco Werman, and the new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, explains his philosophy.
American leadership still matters. The reality is the world simply does not organize itself.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Very glad to have you here. We begin today in India, where the anger of farmers is intensifying. Today, as India celebrated a national holiday, tens of thousands of farmers marched, rode horses, and drove tractors into India's capital, Delhi. The farmers stormed an iconic historic site, the Red Fort, a kind of take that to Prime Minister Narendra Modi. For 2 months now, farmers across India have been protesting, peacefully for the most part. They're furious about new laws that remove fixed prices for their goods. Prime Minister Modi says the changes will benefit farmers. Farmers are not buying it. Vishwajit Singh is a Sikh American artist and activist. He works with United Sikhs, a human rights and humanitarian aid organization affiliated with the United Nations. He joins us from New York. Well, Vish, one of the reasons we wanted to speak with you today is that your organization, United Sikhs, is very active on the ground at these protests in India. What kind of help are you providing?
We have been on the ground since October and November. Initially, very initially, there were needs for food, but very quickly that turned into medical needs. So these farmers have left their homes and traveled hundreds of kilometers to the border of the capital city of Delhi, and our teams have been providing medical services, ambulance services, urgent care needs, then subsequently water services. You literally have cities that have cropped up on the border of capital of Delhi with farmers from all over India camped there, need water for drinking, for washing, bathing, and cooking. We're providing those services. We're providing tent services for farmers to sleep and live in. Winter clothing. India is seeing one of the coldest winters in the last 50 years. And now you have issues of collecting trash and disposing of it. So we're actually helping with those as well. We are on the ground with over 150 team members and volunteers, including physicians and nurses who are serving the needs of farmers, including, I want to emphasize, even security forces who at times have come in and we have provided services to them, because our motto is recognize the human race as one. We serve any and everyone who is in need.
I'm just curious, though, are many of the protesting farmers sick?
A lot of them hail from the state of Punjab, and they happen to be Sikh, yes, but this movement really is national in scope. Its leadership in some ways has been by Punjab farmers who happen to be Sikh. A lot of they sort of really started first and foremost, because Punjab also happens to be the breadbasket of India. It does produce certain foods that are used by the entire nation, and Indians know Punjab as a breadbasket. So, you know, they felt, the farmers in Punjab and Haryana, the neighboring state, felt that they were going to be impacted by these laws the most. So they have been at the forefront, but there are farmers from all over India who are supporting from far away and also on the borders of Delhi.
Your activism is often about identity and representation of Sikhs in the United States. What's moved you, Vish, to take such an active role in the farmer protests in India?
I was born in the United States in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., but my parents hailed from India. They hailed from the state of Punjab. Both my grandparents came from farming backgrounds, and I spent part of my childhood, when I used to go back to India, my summers in the farmlands of Punjab, and I have a deep connection and much appreciation for what farmers do. I consider them the most essential of workers. I call them real-life superheroes. You know, they feed us. In the images and videos that have come out in the past few months and are still coming out, I see my grandparents. All of them have passed away, but I keep seeing their faces in this protest, which is amazingly, there's a lot of old people in these protests, people in their 70s and 80s who have been there for weeks. And I'm just in awe of their sheer power and determination to be out there in the cold weather, out in the open, amidst a global pandemic, to stand up for their rights. How desperate they must be. There has to be something very substantial that they're standing up for.
Yeah, no, it is really impressive and impactful. So for people in the U.S. who've seen footage of tens of thousands of these Indian farmers protesting on foot and on top of tractors encircling the capital of Delhi, I mean, it's really dramatic. When you look more deeply, Vish, how do you see the American connection here beyond the experience that Farmers Feed Us and some U.S. farmers have had this experience around pricing?
Protest movements, actually over the past few years, but especially last year, we've seen a lot of Black Lives Matter movements. You know, these might seem like very different issues, and they are different issues, but fundamentally, they are issues about equity and equality. One is race-based. The other is based on livelihood, farmers who are seeking economic justice. And I remind people, look, we have those similar issues here as well. But for us, racial equality is at the forefront. Income equality is not removed from that. That is part of the equation here in the United States too. And at some level, farmers are actually talking about income equality and safeguarding their livelihoods. So that is one of the conversations we don't tend to have a lot, but it's part of our national political conversation is income equality, right? I mean, that is there. And we've had people who, especially, I mean, in both parties, interestingly, in the U.S., that issue comes up. It's just that it sometimes gets overwhelmed by other issues, but income equality is something that we see here a big issue in the United States, and it's a big issue, if not even a bigger issue in India.
Vishwajit Singh in New York. He's a Sikh American artist and activist. His organization, United Sikhs, has volunteers on the ground in India helping the protesting farmers in Delhi. Vish, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here's an unbelievable statistic. North Korea has officially declared zero cases of COVID-19. Literally unbelievable. There is no one who follows North Korea who really believes that number. But what's undeniable is that the pandemic has made an already reclusive country even more isolated. North Korea has sealed off its borders. Only a trickle of goods, and that includes food, is coming in. And North Koreans are desperate. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, don't expect the regime in Pyongyang to beg the outside world for help.
If you want to know how North Koreans are doing, find out what's on their plates. If it's rice, that's always a good sign, says Fyodor Tertitsky, an expert on North Korea at Kukmin University.
Rice is middle-class food. I mean, if you're middle-class, you can afford it in rice. If you're like working class or if you're really poor, you eat corn.
Corn. Right now, lots of families are eating cheap corn, he says. Next up after that is famine, which has happened before. And Tertitsky says it could happen again.
Things are just that bad.
Just a year or two ago, North Korea was on a roll. The Kim regime was letting people shop in semi-official markets, you know, like capitalism. You could get fake Nikes in Pyongyang. And then along came Trump, sitting down with Kim Jong-un to talk peace, with their meetings broadcast on North Korean TV. And to North Korea, that seemed good too, because the U.S. keeps a stranglehold on their economy through sanctions. Kim Jong-un thought he could get America to loosen up those sanctions. But then...
He's quite a guy and quite a character, and I think our relationship is very strong. But at this time, we had some options, and at this time, we decided not to do any of the options, and we'll see where that goes.
It didn't go anywhere. It embarrassed Kim Jong-un, and that, experts say, empowered the regime's super conservatives. They want to go back to the old ways of doing things. This is a song about potatoes, distributed by the government. Used to be everyone in North Korea toiled in a work unit, getting food through a public distribution system. That's how they got everything. Pants, farm tools, potatoes, rice if they were lucky. And I've interviewed North Koreans who grew up under the system. Women like Kim Ara, a defector, who told me about her meals as a kid. It was nothing to sing about. They got so little rice, she says, that they'd take one spoon of it, throw it in a pot with a bunch of grass, then boil it in water to make soup. That was dinner for four during the famine. This system was so terrible that it mostly collapsed in the 90s, and the government had to let people shop in markets just to survive. Yet some North Korean elites who never had to eat grass soup are nostalgic for those days, the days when, Tertitsky says, they had absolute control over everything. Even what people put on their plates.
Some views which should have gone extinct decades ago still exist there.
Those views were on display this month at a huge political meeting in Pyongyang. it became very clear. This orthodox ideological thought is back in a very big way. Here's Kim Jong-un himself. Comrades, he says, our people have placed trust in me, high as the sky and deep as the sea. But I have failed to always live up to that trust, and I'm sorry. Yeah, a dictator saying sorry. He even cried a little. Sounds progressive, right? Well, look at what he's sorry for setting unrealistic economic goals, which have been ruined by lying Americans and, of course, COVID-19. So now they're going retro. Tertitsky says they probably can't totally wipe out all free market business or fully rebuild the old distribution system to its former state.
I don't think we would be able to completely rebuild it. It's just we want to. So this is very, very bad.
What hardliners want is more juche, an ideology of extreme self-reliance. For example, now they won't even take medical supplies donated from South Korea during a pandemic. Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, also a senior figure, recently called South Korean leaders top-class idiots. And then, at a parade about a week ago, North Korea shows off this giant new missile, big as a subway car. They claim they've got nukes that can hit America, with Kim Jong-un saying the U.S. is still, quote, our biggest enemy, no matter who is in power. Sounds like a message to Joe Biden, and his administration's plan for North Korea isn't super clear yet, but many expect him to mimic his old boss, Barack Obama, following his strategy.
Was called strategic patience, which is a good expression for doing nothing.
Or nothing new, at least. Just squeezing North Korea with sanctions, turning the screws so hard that one day, supposedly, they'll say, we can't stand it, come take our nukes. Outside of Washington, D.C., this is seen as fantasy. After all, North Korea is now in serious pain, isolated, broke, its people surviving on corn. And that's not bringing them to the table. It might just be making them even more hostile. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
A new president means new funding priorities, starting with money to help the world adapt to the impacts of climate change.
We've reached the point where it is an absolute fact that it's cheaper to invest in preventing damage, or minimizing it at least, than cleaning up.
Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, speaking at a virtual UN summit yesterday, one of his first appearances since the Biden administration announced it would rejoin the UN climate agreement.
So we're proud to be back. We come back, I want you to know, with humility for the absence of the last 4 years, and we'll do everything in our power to make up for it.
The event was aimed at rallying funds for adaptation, in other words, money to build seawalls, relocating vulnerable populations, or combating urban heat. The UN says right now it costs developing countries $70 billion a year to adapt to climate change, and that could skyrocket up to $300 billion in the next decade. Kerry stressed that cutting greenhouse gas emissions fast is essential for those vulnerable communities.
There is simply no adapting to a 3 or 4 degree world except for the very richest and most privileged. At the same time, we have to also build resilience to protect communities from the impacts of climate change that are already built in to the emissions that are in the atmosphere.
Kerry pledged to make good on money promised under previous administrations. The U.S. owes $2 billion to a UN Green Climate Fund. At the same event, the president of Gabon, Ali Bongo Ondimba, spoke about the human side of adapting to climate change.
The devastating effects of climate change are on the rise, especially on the African continent. Unchecked, climate change would create hundreds of millions of climate refugees in Africa by the middle of the century.
2021 is considered essential for the success of the Paris Climate Agreement. Countries are expected to make new pledges for carbon emission cuts by the end of the year, and right now, all eyes are on the United States. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Syria is now entering its 10th year of conflict. What began as a group of activists clamoring for democracy got violently shut down by President Bashar al-Assad, then morphed into a civil war, and today Syria is a battleground where neighboring countries are settling scores with one another. Iran and Israel are two of them. Israel has been ramping up airstrikes in Syria, targeting Iran's proxies there. The question is, could this lead to a wider conflict? Elizabeth Serkov is a fellow with the Center for Global Policy based in Washington, and she joins us from Istanbul. Let's start with this wave of Israeli airstrikes on the Syrian targets, Elizabeth. Israelis have a no-comment policy on these attacks, but what can you tell us about what you know?
So we're basically seeing at least three rounds of airstrikes on Iranian-linked positions in Syria in the span of just 2 weeks. So we're definitely seeing an intensification of airstrikes, including in areas quite removed from Israel, so in central Syria near Hama, and also in Deir ez-Zor, all the way to the east of the country near the border with Iraq.
What do you think Israel's strategy is here? What are they trying to achieve?
So Israel, the official stated policy and goal is to bring about the removal of all Iranian forces and Iranian-linked forces. Iran has deployed tens of thousands of foreign Shia fighters to Syria to back the Assad regime. Israel aims to have all of these forces removed and also all the bases that these forces established and the missiles they brought in and other types of weaponry, all of that gone. However, that goal seems a bit ambitious, and in private, Israeli officials accept some kind of Iranian presence as long as it doesn't threaten Israel. And what they perceive as particularly threatening is a presence close to the Israeli border, which makes sense, and also presence of missiles, as well as transfers of weaponry and particularly precision-guided missiles or any kind of GPS systems that help turn regular missiles into precision-guided missiles to Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed militia that operates in Lebanon and, you know, since the start of the civil war in Syria, also in Syria.
So you mentioned the intensification of these airstrikes. Why do you think they're increasing at the moment? What does it tell us about what's going on right now?
So there are several different ways to explain this. I think that the fact that, you know, the Trump administration was leaving office is now such a sensitive time while the Biden administration comes in that Iran does not appear interested in escalating the situation. It wants to try and patch things up. With the Biden administration, it is likely that the U.S. administration and the Iranians will re-enter negotiations concerning the nuclear agreement, the JCPOA, which Trump withdrew from. And therefore, Israel kind of has an opportunity to maybe more aggressively strike Iranian targets without risk of Iranian retaliation.
The Biden administration has pledged to consult with Israel on all matters of regional security. How do he and his national security team view these airstrikes? Do they worry that maybe they could have unintended consequences?
I think that with regards to Israeli strikes in Syria, not so much. It seems to me that the Biden administration will not express any kind of opposition to continued Israeli airstrikes. And the Obama administration also does not appear that it constrained Israel when it comes to strikes in Syria. And basically, the Biden administration is Obama administration, the third term, basically, in terms of personnel in the foreign policy establishment, at least the appointments that have been announced thus far.
Elizabeth Serkov is a fellow with the Center for Global Policy based in Washington. She's been speaking with us from Istanbul. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Across much of Europe, ski resorts are shut down. Germany, Italy, and France all decided not to open the slopes until at least mid-February because of COVID-19. Initially, Austria balked at the idea of shutting down its $18 billion winter tourist season, but as infections spread, things changed. Amanda Peacher has our story.
At the Flachau ski resort, about an hour outside of Salzburg, a few couples stand near outdoor speakers at an après ski hut. Inside the hut, chairs are stacked and lights are off. The slope above is like a blank white sheet with only an occasional skier or snowboarder dotting the run.
Yeah, I've seen viel weniger Leute.
Ski lift operator Robert Huber says there are definitely fewer people here. He watches as one lone skier wearing a mask gets on the chairlift.
Everything is wonderfully prepared, but there aren't any people here. It's a pity. It's beautiful weather. You can see for yourself. The snow is good. The slope is good. The sun is great.
Ski hills close to big cities are seeing lots of skiers and in some cases have actually been criticized for crowding. But most of the resorts in the Austrian Alps are too far for day trips from Vienna or other big cities. And even though Germany is close by, you can't just cross the border and ski for a day because of quarantine requirements. Robert Huber thinks that's a pity.
I think that it's very important for people who live in a city who may only see fog or only buildings in front of them. At some point, they have to come out to move physically and be in the sun and in the fresh air, because otherwise people get crazy stupid.
A short drive away, a little medieval town called Rudstadt is hurting for lack of tourists. On a normal winter day, people crowd the restaurants here to order a frothy beer and a sausage after a day on the slopes. But of course, not right now.
It's more like a ghost town.
That's Christian Koblinger. He heads the tourism office in Rudstadt. Austria has been partially or completely locked down since mid-November.
Shops are closed down, restaurants are closed down, hotels are closed down.
Koblinger says normally this time of year hotels are booked and it's hard to get dinner reservations.
The winter is typically pretty busy. We have people mostly from Germany and Austria and the Netherlands. And right now we don't have any guests.
The 2018-19 winter season raked in almost $18 billion in Austria. Tourism and leisure accounts for a whopping 15% share of Austria's gross domestic product. The Austrian government is providing some financial aid to businesses hobbled by the shutdown. Koblinger says that help doesn't cover all the losses.
It's devastating. We relied on tourism for the last 40, 50 years, so we can't change that in a heartbeat.
In the meantime, the only people who can enjoy the ski slopes are locals. If you can get to the ski hill and home in a day, then great, you can go skiing. Martina Leitner is doing just that.
Perfect. Perfect conditions, great weather.
Leitner is wrapping up a day skiing with her 8-year-old daughter. She says they had a great time.
Really, really disciplined people. Everybody's keeping distance and everybody's wearing his or her mask. And yes, it's really, really nice.
There are no lines at the chairlifts. But Leitner says it's bittersweet to ski like this. She knows resorts can't operate without more skiers and snowboarders to pay for lift tickets.
Every year it couldn't be like that, because otherwise we wouldn't have that much lift stations and everything else because it's just not affordable.
Leitner says even though it's nice to experience solitude at a resort that's usually packed, she's looking forward to next winter and welcoming tourists to Austria once again. For The World, I'm Amanda Peacher in Austria.
You're listening to The World. Latino voters came out in force in November, going 3-1 for Joe Biden. The impacts could be long-lasting. Some Latino Republicans are no longer sure the GOP is for them, with Trump still around.
He's made it more, instead of like you're voting for like the Republican Party or you're supporting the Republican ideas, you're kind of more supporting him, you know?
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The United States has a new top diplomat. Antony Blinken was confirmed today as Secretary of State. He even got some bipartisan support in the Senate. Blinken's going to have his work cut out for him. The list of big global challenges he faces includes a pandemic, climate change, and repairing fractured relationships. Then there's Russia. President Biden had his first conversation with Vladimir Putin today. Behind the telephone pleasantries, though, there's a lot U.S. diplomacy is going to have to contend with at the Russia desk. For more on that, here's The World's Daniel Offman.
President Trump's relationship with Russia was complicated.
It would be great if we could get along with Russia, just so you understand that. Now, tomorrow you'll say, Donald Trump wants to get along with Russia. This is terrible. It's not terrible. It's good.
That was February 2017, It was a message Trump repeated throughout his presidency. But the real shocker came in July 2018 in Helsinki. Standing on a stage next to Russian President Vladimir Putin, Trump was asked if he agreed with U.S. intelligence agencies. They concluded that Russia tried to meddle in the 2016 presidential election.
They said they think it's Russia. President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this, I don't see any reason why it would be.
Here was a sitting U.S. president saying he trusts Putin over his own intelligence community. There's a new president in the White House, and now a new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. But U.S. lawmakers are still plenty worried about Russia. Here's Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, laying out some of those concerns during Blinken's confirmation hearing.
Navalny, his poisoning and his arrest.
That's Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, probably Putin's harshest critic.
SolarWinds.
That's the massive computer hack that experts attribute to Russia.
Bounty on U.S. soldiers.
Allegations that Russia paid Taliban militants bounties to kill U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. And Menendez went on.
Election interference, the use of chemical weapons to assassinate opponents in different parts of the world. Clearly, Russia must face consequences for its actions. Otherwise, it thinks it can continue to violate the international order.
So where does Antony Blinken stand on all of this? His response to Menendez offers some insight into the Biden administration's thinking on Russia.
The things you mentioned are egregious in so many ways. The president-elect has been very clear that there need to be costs and sustained consequences.
Blinken mentioned that the administration has the tools it needs to impose sanctions against bad actors. He went on to articulate a vision for U.S. foreign policy that's distinct from Trump's America First approach.
American leadership still matters. The reality is the world simply does not organize itself.
That's Blinken addressing the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee last week during his opening statement.
When we're not engaged, when we're not leading, then one of two things is likely to happen. Either some other country tries to take our place, but not in a way that's likely to advance our interests and values, or maybe just as bad, no one does, and then you have chaos. Either way, that does not serve the American people.
Even before his confirmation, Blinken spoke up about what he sees as human rights violations abroad, including in Russia, where authorities detained opposition leader Alexei Navalny a little over a week ago.
Mr. Navalny is a voice, I think, for millions and millions and millions of Russians, and their voice needs to be heard in Russia. And the attempts to silence that voice by silencing Mr. Navalny is something that we strongly condemn.
Beyond human rights, Blinken also sees potential for the U.S. and Russia to cooperate on global security. He said one of the Biden administration's first goals will be to extend the New START treaty that puts limits on the nuclear arsenals of both countries.
New START is not some kind of gift we give to the Russians. It's manifestly in our self-interest in terms of giving us a predictable cap on the core of Russia's nuclear arsenal, as well as giving us tremendous access to data and inspections that we otherwise wouldn't have. And so, in our judgment, it is certainly in the national interest to extend it.
Managing the relationship with Russia will be tricky. But Blinken has at least one real advantage, says former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul. He worked with Blinken during the Obama years.
He's so comfortable in his own skin. This is not a person with a giant ego. He's not going to be worried about the kind of knife fighting that sometimes happens within administrations because he's so confident in his relationship with President Biden.
McFaul says that that's important to be successful as Secretary of State. World leaders need to know that Blinken truly speaks for the president, that they are in complete lockstep. The new administration's first challenge with Russia will come soon. The New START treaty is set to expire in less than 2 weeks. For the world, I'm Daniel Offman.
Turning now to the pandemic, the new variants of the coronavirus are a concern for everyone. It's prompted governments in Europe and the U.S. to restrict travel as scientists learn more about how vaccines and treatments could work with the new strains. The World's Ilana Gordon has been following the latest developments. What exactly are these variants, Ilana, and how many are there now?
So to understand this whole variant thing, Marco, I want to start with a little breakdown of the virus itself. Because when the coronavirus, when it gets into cells, it replicates. And it replicates and replicates and replicates. And in that process, it may make some typos. This typo, it's called a mutation, and that's to be expected. And then as the virus continues to spread, if you're with me, it sometimes takes that typo along with it. Scientists around the world, Marco, have been tracking the virus and these typos to see how it gets around and evolves. But they've identified some sets of typos or mutations that are becoming more common. And these sets or combination of mutations, that is generally what scientists mean when they say a variant.
And can I ask, Ilana, just exactly how they do this, how they spot these mutations, these typos, as you put it?
So scientists are tracking this by taking samples. I talked to Mary Petrone. She's a scientist at Yale who does this. They take the samples from those nasal swabs of positive COVID tests.
So the first thing that we need to do is once we have those samples is to extract the RNA from all the samples, because you can imagine there's a lot of stuff in there. There's boogers, there's spit, you know, there's whatever there might be. So you have to go in and take out the RNA first, because that's where the genetic code is for the virus.
So Marco, she extracts the RNA or genetic material of the virus. She then runs it through another sequencing process. That lays out the genomic code of the virus sample, and that code includes any typos or indicators of variants.
Let me just say, first of all, much respect for a scientist who is able to talk low to the rest of us and use the word booger. Tell me about these variants. Where are they? How many are there?
What's come to scientists' attention are variants so far that they've termed, quote, variants of concern. One of the variants was found in the UK, another was discovered in Brazil, and another in South Africa.
And why are they of concern if they're kind of simply typos?
So these combinations at the population level, scientists in places like the UK have observed that the variant has become a lot more common. They worry that it appears to be more easily transmittable. On Friday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson also said this.
It also now appears that there is some evidence that the new variant, the variant that was first identified in London and the southeast, may be associated with a higher degree of mortality.
Some evidence. I mean, we had heard about that. That is concerning, if true.
Scientists are cautious about making conclusions about this, but it has caught their attention.
And what about the effect on treatments and vaccines? Could these variants impact that?
So both Moderna and Pfizer, some of the main vaccine makers, they've said that their vaccines do work against the variants at this point. Moderna did say yesterday that the vaccine appears to be less protective against the variant found in South Africa. And so as a backup, they're now developing and testing an additional booster shot. Paul Benesch is a virologist at Rockefeller University in New York City. I talked with him about this. He studies COVID treatments. And he says that over time, these variants and the virus's evolution could require vaccine makers and treatments to adapt.
It's not going to be the case that the vaccine will suddenly stop working. It's that each one of these changes just erodes a little bit.
Mm. And do they know why it could impact vaccines or treatments?
So one clue that they are looking into about whether this is a possibility is that these variants, even though they're separate, they have developed similar characteristics that seem to affect the sensitivity of some of the antibodies in the body's defense systems. These antibodies are the ones that detect and kind of attack the virus. So the question is whether some or one of these variants may develop a way to get around those defenses a little better, and whether that might also impact reinfections too. But again, Marco, like, they're still learning. Immunity is super complex.
When I zoom out, Ilana, and think about how viruses mutate to begin with, even in a benign way, it seems like there's a lot of infections and so much spread, like that gives the virus more opportunities to develop an edge. Am I wrong?
Scientists like Paul Benesch say this is a really important part of the story.
If every country in the world was in the situation that, say, Australia, New Zealand, and certain Asian countries were in, then we would have much, much less of a problem with viral variants.
And so this is why global health leaders, Marco, continue to stress the importance of these other measures to take, things like prevention and social distancing, testing, and containment.
Right, the old mantra. The World's Ilana Gordon with the latest news on COVID variants. Thank you very much, Alana.
You're welcome, Marco.
Riots have erupted in several cities in the Netherlands over the past 3 nights. Looters broke into shops, overturned cars, and set fires. Police responded with water cannon and charged the demonstrators on horseback. On Sunday, young Dutch on a rampage in the city of Urk set a COVID testing center on fire. Why all this? Well, the unrest follows the Dutch government's decision to impose a 9 p.m. curfew to help stop the spread of the coronavirus. Masha ten Bruggenkatte chairs the Council for Amsterdam Central District. Masha, officials in Amsterdam made close to 200 arrests last night. What does it look like during these evening protests? Is protest even the right word for what's happening?
It looks like a riot. On the Museum Square, which is quite well known around the world, where the famous Rijksmuseum is, it was a big riot over there with police squads and the water cannons pushing out a combination of people. Part of the people just comes there to demonstrate against the regulations and the 9 o'clock curfew. But the other part, well, they look like hooligans and they really come for a fight. So at night, people are running into the neighborhoods where they're looting in the shops, which nowadays makes a lot of shop owners really scared.
And it sounds from like what you said, Masha, is that the rioters are not just motivated by the 9 p.m. curfew. It sounds like there are a whole range of discontents.
Yes, it's both youngsters that are really bored by the regulations that we already have for almost a year now. It's well-organized hooligans that are really out to start riots and to loot the shops. And there are people that are, well, worried about what's happening due to corona.
So this curfew, the 9 p.m. curfew, it's the first nighttime lockdown in Holland since the Nazis occupied the country during World War II. Do you think most residents of the Netherlands support the new curfew?
I think a lot of people really want to get rid of corona. So for me personally, I'm just waiting until everybody is vaccinated and we can start our lives again. And then for these last weeks, anything that has to be done has to be done. People that are comparing these days with the Second World War really makes me angry because it's a completely different time. It's a completely different government. And some of the rioters make this comparison, and I think it's completely wrong.
You know, when I look at the riots online, Masha, I see some demonstrators in the red MAGA hats, the Make America Great Again hats. Are you seeing that? And are elements of the Dutch far right prominent in these demonstrations?
I'm very happy that I didn't see those hats. Of course, these type of people, the Trumpists and other right-wing supporters, the way they express themselves on social media doesn't help to keep the country quiet and peaceful.
We tend to think of the Dutch as having a liberal, laissez-faire approach to so much of life. Is that attitude, if you agree with that, is that attitude incompatible with curfews? Do you think that's part of the problem?
For Europe, we're not used to curfews. We're not used to these harsh government regulations. But I wouldn't explain the riots by that, because we're already under more or less of strict regulations to fight the coronavirus for the last 9 months. Longer even.
I mean, we should recognize that the Dutch are also known for their tolerance. So it's curious to see people responding with such intolerance to this curfew for what is
yes,
a relatively short amount of time.
And because it doesn't help at all. We have hospitals that are still full of people fighting corona. So we really want people to express themselves when they don't agree on the regulations government gives. But in this way, it doesn't help at all.
Finally, Masha, speaking of the police in the Netherlands, I've seen Dutch police at these demonstrations on horseback and other groups of police heading toward the unrest on bicycles. Bicycle police in a riot feels very Dutch in what is no doubt a frightening level of violence. I'm just curious, how do the protesters respond to the police on bicycle?
The policemen on bicycles are, well, let's say the first line. The policemen on horseback are a second line, but there are also policemen completely in their, well, how do you call it, fighting suit. The riot police, they are professionals fighting them. So there's different levels of police. And I prefer the policeman on a bicycle because that is what we're used to in our normal life.
Masha ten Bruggenkatte chairs the Council of Amsterdam Central District. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I am the loud voice when the world wants to hear the sound of silence. That's from a video put out by the Egyptian cartoonist Ashraf Hamdi. On the 10th anniversary of the uprising in Tahrir Square, Hamdi made a tribute to some of the revolutionaries who battled Egyptian security forces in 2011. Yesterday, after he posted that video, Hamdi wrote on Facebook, "I'm getting arrested." According to Reuters, he was taken early in the morning and will be investigated for, quote, misusing social media and spreading false news. The protests in Egypt that began this week 10 years ago brought down the regime of Hosni Mubarak. Human rights groups say the current atmosphere under the rule of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is even worse. Dozens of Egyptian journalists have been jailed in recent years, hundreds of websites blocked, not to mention the irony of Egyptian authorities arresting someone on the 10th anniversary of the uprising because that person was marking the 10th anniversary of the uprising. Rights groups are calling on Egypt's government to release cartoonist Ashraf Hamdi immediately. From anti-curfew protests in the Netherlands to the latest on COVID variants and farmer protests in India, you listen to the world to connect to the world. Continue that connection online, on Twitter, share the stories that keep you thinking, and meet the journalists who report them. We are on Twitter at The World. We had a sense the jump was big, but the data is now in, and according to UCLA's Policy and Politics Initiative, the Latino vote in November's election increased by more than 30% compared to 4 years ago. Biden won by wide margins across much of the country, 3-1 in the key swing states of Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. For many conservative Latinos, November left them with a tough choice. Over the past year on the show, we profiled young Latino voters like 19-year-old Jacob Cuenca. He voted for the first time in November.
I just believe in conservatism. I feel like you can just get it, you can achieve everything just by working hard enough. As long as you have your mindset and you have a dream, you have that like that glare in your eyes and you like, you know, you can do whatever you want, honestly. You really can.
Cuenca began his political journey as a registered Republican, but the tumultuous election cycle and the pandemic changed his mind. For our Every 30 Second series, Danny Rivera from WLRN in Miami has this update.
2020 was 19-year-old Jacob Cuenca's first time ever voting in an election. And what a ride it's been. Even though he liked President Trump at first, he decided to vote for Joe Biden. That's because Jacob was unimpressed with how Trump handled the pandemic, and he became increasingly alarmed about Trump's behavior.
It's crazy that he's the type of person who was like my first president, you know, like, I feel like there's not going to be a person like him for a long time afterwards.
Jacob's mom is from Mexico. She's a Democrat. His dad is from Cuba. He's a Republican. And even though Jacob considers himself pretty conservative, he's also pretty liberal on things like climate change and abortion rights. He wears his hair long and bleached like Kurt Cobain and listens to tons of 90s grunge music. And on one level, Jacob finds Trump a little entertaining. He kind of likes anti-establishment figures. But he also found it alarming when Trump refused to concede the election. This was Jacob in November.
It's kind of a scary thought that he doesn't concede like sometime in December soon. Like, I don't know, he might just go all the way until like when Biden's trying to go to the office and he's probably going to hold like his own little like Trump supporter rally like when he's doing his inauguration. I think it's crazy the type of support that he's instilled into these people and like how some people are like go fight with for him till like the end. It's like a cult.
As we now know, that prediction was more than a little justified.
And he did. He did do it.
Jacob watched the scene unfold on TV and social media when a swarm of pro-Trump extremists stormed the U.S. Capitol, trying to reverse the election. 5 people died. And Trump did not attend Biden's inauguration.
It's so strange how much infighting he's caused and everywhere in the United States government and politics. I've never seen so much like division and turmoil.
I've followed Jacob for close to a year now. And that means that as I've watched him evolve in his politics, I've also watched him live through some major life events during a global pandemic. He graduated from high school without a prom and held off going to college at the University of Denver this fall because of COVID-19. And in January, he had to delay school for another semester. In the meantime, he found a temporary job working at a warehouse that ships liquor. And he likes working. He likes making money.
It's given me time to reflect about like the state of the world and just like chill. Like, and also too, like, I feel like I needed like a break from high school and stuff like that, man. Like, honestly, I was tired. It was grinding.
Jacob says the last year has been a harsh introduction to politics for a self-described conservative. He still sees himself as a Republican, but definitely not a Trump Republican.
He's made it more, instead of like you're voting for like the Republican Party or you're supporting Republican ideas, you're kind of more supporting him, you know? I don't even know what's going to happen to the Republican Party too after him, like, because he kind of seems like the face of it now, you know? So I'm interested to see what's going to happen.
Any change, he says, would be a welcome thing. Whatever comes next, Jacob has his fingers crossed that President Joe Biden will have a good presidency. For The World, I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
Danny Rivero joins us now from his home in Miami. Great to have you here, Danny.
Great to be here.
So you started your story describing Jacob Cuenca's past year as a wild ride, and you definitely described that accurately. So Jacob's a registered Republican voting in his first presidential election. He ended up voting for Biden after a long, hard look at what 4 years of Trump amounted to. And yet Jacob is still a registered Republican. Tell us more about that, Danny, and what he's feeling about the GOP, the party he was initially drawn to.
So at the presidential level, Jacob is really feeling kind of without a home at this point. He feels like a Republican. He feels conservative deep down in his bones. But the way that's been represented at the top of the ticket the last couple of years has just, it's become unraveled. You know, he does not any longer support the Trump Republicanism. At the same time, a little bit lower down the ballot, he did vote Republican in a congressional race that we had. So he still sees some bit of representation, but whatever the party does moving forward, he really wants it to look different than Trump starting from the top.
And it's interesting how Jacob became conservative. I mean, family often has a huge political influence on kids, but Jacob's family was politically mixed, mom a Democrat, while Jacob's dad is a Republican. How much of their views influenced Jacob? Would you say he was swinging between the sway of his two parents, or was he more independently kind of making up his own mind?
You know, I did ask that question directly to Jacob, and he said, you know, he basically came to understand things as his own. I think people that grow up in mixed families, if not being swayed one direction or the other, it does make people more likely to be open to listen to other points of view. You know, when I started talking to Jacob last March, when he first registered to vote, he was Republican, but he was open to hearing the other side. You know, he saw some things in Bernie Sanders that he liked. He was still a Republican. And you know, he was kind of open to being talked into a different position, if you will.
So zooming out, Florida was a state where former President Donald Trump had a lot of visibility, a lot of support. What is your takeaway, Danny, after following and covering the Latino electorate in Florida? Did we learn anything important this election cycle?
You know, I don't know what we learned. I mean, it's definitely a subject of much debate, but so much of this comes down to just individual characters and characteristics and family histories. You know, like I mentioned, Jacob comes from a politically mixed family. That might have played a role in him being swayed away from being a fan of or former President Donald Trump, who he was a fan of originally. At the same time, there's a lot of Latinos here that come from families that have Republicans on both sides. And what we saw in the last election cycle was a lot of those kind of families actually became more entrenched. They became more Republican, more aligned with the Republican Party under President Trump. And it remains to be seen with former President Trump taking, you know, he's kind of faded already a little bit into the background. We don't know how visible he'll be in 2022, 2024, if that kind of entrenchment continues or if people are going to be more open to different things and on the Democratic side, too, as well.
That's Danny Rivero from WLRN in Miami. He's a reporter with our Every 30 Seconds series that looked at the young Latino electorate. Danny, it was really great having you as part of the project. So thanks again for the time you put in and bringing us the stories about Jacob Cuenca and helping us understand what's happened in Florida this past year.
Thanks, Marco, and thanks to your whole team.
And that's going to do it. Our time is up for today. You can always find us online at theworld.org. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Stay safe, be strong, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. From PRX.